History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Take a little time, ask a few questions, and maybe most importantly, listen. You might just be amazed by what you hear. Our goal with this program, first and foremost, has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as a result of all that, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up drawing inspiration and newfound perspective. This coming Thursday, December 7th, is of course the 82nd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And even as the number of Pearl Harbor survivors has dwindled, wherever you're listening today, there will likely be a remembrance ceremony in your community. We've been privileged to share dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors' stories on Hometown Heroes over the years, and we'll have a special episode with that theme next time. But this week, we have to finish up the conversation we started last week with someone for whom World War II started before Pearl Harbor, because he grew up in the Netherlands. If you missed last week's episode with Dutch Vryhoff, you can pull it up online at hometownheroesradio.com. He was only 7 years old when German paratroopers landed in his village of Rhone, not far from Rotterdam. Soon he and his family were starving, and they were risking their lives to take in a young Jewish girl who had been orphaned. They saved her life, and Dutch's boyhood years were spent with the Dutch underground, sneaking around to steal supplies to live on. When he was tasked with securing ammunition, it almost cost him his life. Here's a brief excerpt of what we heard last time on one of his closest calls.
When we were starting in on the ammunition one day, and it was it had rained. There was a little bit of water in that canal, but not much. We just had gotten two cases with the deals on the handle. It took two of us to carry them, and so there was two cases. There was four guys, and on the other guys they had some more egg powder. And all of a sudden, one of those stinking German shepherds broke loose, and he came there and he started. He came in and tried to attack us, and of course the guard came out there. And he'd seen what was going on. Now this is, you probably say, you socked this out of your tomb, but I didn't, this is a true story. This guard, he set up a machine gun, and he kept rattling it, and every time, and we were in this canal, and we had to stay down, and then they came, the several soldiers came, and they took all our stuff away, and they gave us a beating, and they let us go. And that was the truth. So we all peed in our pants, because we were just petrified and thought they're going to kill us. They set up a machine gun with a deal like that, and they laid behind it and they kept just rattling over the canal, and we couldn't move. And the German shepherd right on the edge over there, trying to attack, and they had to restrain that dog because of a killer. They had four of them.
Again, you can hear the first part of our conversation with Dutch Vryhoff at hometownheroesradio.com. But let's get to the rest of the story now.
And then, towards the end of the war, the American bombers, they came over and they dropped food, big old containers with food. And people went crazy at first, and then they underground organized where they would control it, and then everybody would get a portion. I remember they were little wieners in cans, and then there was, Spam, and then there was crackers, just big old containers of crackers. Yeah, and they dropped them. And the Germans, they wanted part of it too, because they were going hungry. They were running out of fuel, and they were, by now, they first had armored vehicles, and they had a Volkswagen, a small truck, and it sat about six soldiers, and it had it was ambitious. They can get in the canal with it. It had a prop on the back. And they went all over with those things. Yeah, but they ran out of fuel, so they were using horses now to move their troops around. It was done with horses, yeah, towards the end. Then, of course, the next thing happened, another big drama, is one day I back to Rotterdam, and then when I came home, I had to help my dad get ready, stuff ready for the market the next day. It was just a normal thing. And I still remember on the path to our field, there was a warehouse there and on with a lorry, and on there was, and this foxhole, there was an English square sedan, it was called a foxhole. And four guys came out, and they were dressed in black suits with the NSB label on, that was a socialist label. And they said, where is your dad? I said, he's in the back of the field, he's getting cauliflower. They said, go get him. I said, well, he's not ready. And that ground over there is heavy clay, okay? And when it rains, it sucks. And your wooden shoe would get sucked into the clay. And we had a small lorry, and it was a little cart, and it had small railroad wheels on a track. We put load of stuff, and then you would walk behind it, and that way, between the tracks, they had some whatever material, and your wooden shoes would not stick. So that would never come out of the field till he was ready, because after the rain, that's how he would be able to move. So they waited over there, impatient, and finally he was ready to come. And they told him, are you Joe Vryov? Yeah, that's me. He says, well, you got 6 months to get over your land, because we're taking it over for Volkshousing, houses for the people. And my dad said, well, this has been in the family since the 1800s. This is not for sale. And they got Maori with them, and they said, that's how it is. And here is the paper. Well, my dad became upset, and he went to my grandfather, who was a member of the city council, and they said they were going to pay him 10,000 guildens for it. That was all. And so he went to my grandfather, and my grandfather, he said, well, I'll take that up with the city council tomorrow. And they had an attorney. So they protested it, and a big deal, and they evaluated, and it was worth 40,000 instead of 10. And it was a big fight, but they lost. And so we were notified that we had to be off of the land.
And that's after the war?
That was after the war. The socialists came to power. The dirty socialists and communists came to power. I think it was between 45 and 46. The war was just over when they came to power. And you see, they have the same type of government as England has. They have the first and second, well, we call it Kamer, but that's how they operate. And there's a lot of parties in there. And on, usually the parties what kindly agree on each other, they team up and then they become the power. And the Labour Party and the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, they teamed up and they kicked the Queen out of power. And Drees took over. He was the Prime Minister. He was a socialist. And that's what happened. So the first thing they did is they took property. Then they took all the guns, all the shotguns, and even the airbox. We had airboxes in Holland. It's more than a BB gun. You can actually, if you hit somebody in the eye, you can knock the eye out. It's with air, and they call them airbox. Had to turn everything in. Then they took over all the utilities. That was all privately owned. The gas, the electric, and the water. All privately owned. Everybody got kicked off. They took it over. Then they took over the transportation. Okay? The trains and the buses, everything was taken over. And then you had to turn in all the gold and silver. And you say, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, they hired people and they paid them a lot to snitch on you. And that's how that worked. And then they would, you had to turn it in. Yeah.
It was pretty bad during the war, and it was bad after the war.
You better believe it. Ever worse, yes. And then the next thing is they froze the money. And brother, I'm going to tell that right under the microphone, because that is already going to happen here. I told a lot of my business associates, I said, that is what's going to happen, because they're not going to be able to pay their debt to China, and then they're going to freeze the money. That's what they're going to do. And that's what they did in Holland. Didn't matter how much money you had in the bank. If you had $1,000 in the bank, guildens, you only owned 100, and they owned the 900, and they froze it.
That's pretty haunting. And I do want to hear about how you made it to America. But I also, you know, we didn't talk about liberation. And you have some pictures here. It says the Bevrijders, which is Dutch for liberators. I'm sure you have a memory of when your village, your area, was free again, because you'd lived without freedom for years.
Yeah, we were freed in the middle and on the end of 45, and was a big deal. The tanks came in, they were brought over across the canal, or the channel, by big boats, freighters, and the Canadians were, a lot of the Canadians were red-headed, I remember that. they were big bruisers, big guys, and they were all on the tanks, and they thundered through the village, and some of the streets they couldn't go in because they were too small, and they had to go on the outside, and people just went crazy, and it was quite an event.
Do you remember what that felt like for you?
Unbelievable. The Queen came back, and on that, well, that was an enormous celebration. They brought all the flags out, and people who had been starved to death, and they all were being fed again, and things just begin to look up, you know. We give thanks to the Lord for allowing us to be able to survive all this and be still alive, you know. We were really thankful to the Lord for that, and we had a big Thanksgiving. Oh, there was another thing I forgot to tell you. During the war, the Germans controlled the churches. And the ministers all say that, you know, the Bible says that you have to listen to your government and all that stuff. But there was a couple of very outstanding preachers who went around preaching and said that the Germans were not human and that they were devils, and we did not have to obey them, withstand them, and fight them. And they, it was Dominic Knopp. He was a very outstanding preacher. And they got him, and they beat him so bad that he had to have stitches and everything to shut him up. And he came back on the pulpit, and they had an enormous crowd of people, and they sung the Dutch national anthem, and he stole them again. He said, well, I got beat. He says, and I'm telling you that you do not obey the German bloodhounds. That was a bad term for it, but that's what they called them.
You know, the word that just keeps coming back to my mind is courage. It took a lot of courage for you, your family, so many of your countrymen to do what you did during that time. What are the things that you look back on and say, you know, that was pretty significant?
Well, we all stuck together. Oh, and by the way, let me tell you something else which I forgot. When they were dropping the parachutes and all, we were all hiding out because I had bullet holes all in our house and in the barn and everything in the village. They all had big bullet holes. We had a big open pit in the back of the field where they put, there is a certain deal which they grow in Holland, they call it witlof, and it goes in a pit, and they bury it, and then they cover it, okay? And in that hole, my sister was born, way back in the field there. Mom gave birth to her.
During the war?
During the war, yeah, in the early part of the war, in 1940. Yeah, one of my sisters was born in the field, in the back, yeah. And one of the ladies from the village who was a midwife, you know, and she helped.
You know, it just strikes me. I'm thinking of the contrast of what you're describing and what a 10, 11, or 12-year-old boy is experiencing in America today and how much could be taken for granted. I get the sense you're not one who takes very much, if anything, for granted.
No, I mean, it was the biggest thing to know that we were going to go to the United States. I mean, that was really something. The United States, that was, we learned that in school, that was the country or the land of freedom, the land of milk and honey and everything else, you know. And then we were trying to go to Canada first. When they talk of land, you can't get no more land. There's no land. At that time, there was 13 million people living in a country smaller than the state of Utah. That's how Holland is. It's smaller than the state of Utah, and there was 13 million people. I don't know what it is now, but I'm sure there's a whole lot more. But once you lose your possessions like that, you're done. Simple done. So we were on the waiting list to go to the United States. Although first we were going to immigrate to Canada. And my dad had a friend who, right after the war, he had immigrated to Canada because he had family there, Tim Van Dyke. Now you have to bear in mind, Paul, that this is in the 40s, and there was no telephones. And then by airmail, that cost a lot more extra, and my dad didn't have the money, so my grandfather had to pay for the airmail to go to Canada. Canada. Now, you laugh about that, but that's the truth, you know what I mean? Because that was the only communication. So that talk, I think, was a week and a week to respond. And then we went to the American consul. That's all on bike. You go on the bike. That's the only way we was able to move was on the bike to the consul. And then he was not strong enough. So for a family of eight, we came on the boat, on the old steamship, the New Amsterdam. Our passage was paid by the Rabobank, because that's where the money was frozen, in the Rabobank. That's the bank that's here too now. Yeah. That bank is owned by Dutch family. That's not owned by no corporation, no nothing. The Rabobank. It's an agriculture bank. And that was the bank in the village. I got a picture of it in my office. Anyway, they had to give money for the passage over. Only enough for the passage. And we were going to go in the third class. I was in a hole. That's down. You don't see the air, and you're down in the bottom of the ship. That is where all the poor immigrants went, okay? Well, the ship was overbooked, and we were traveling in the second class. Now, that was up above the stairs, and we were just in some element which we've never heard of or never dreamed of. I mean, the waiter's putting his chair underneath your bottom and bringing food which we have only heard of and never seen. It was so bad over in Holland that my uncle had a produce store, and whenever he get bananas for the uppity-ups and they would go rotten, my dad would slice one up with a real thin knife, and we get a little slice and we'd stick our tongue out, and he'd lay a slice of banana on, and we go to school and say we had banana. Man, all the kids in the class, you have banana? Oh, how can you? That's only for rich people. How did you get a banana? Well, it was just a little tiny slice with a half a rotten on our tongue, and it came out of my uncle's gross. Now, this is all true story. So anyway, to make a long story short, we were get a passage, and it was during the time in April, and the North Sea was like a turmoil, and we had to go to Southampton, pick up passage, and we had to go to Le Havre, France, to pick up immigrants. And then we went across. And it took 10 days, and we were in the most horrible storms you can think of, and the ship didn't have the ballast tanks where it would. So the ship was tossed, and everything was tied down, and we couldn't eat anymore, and there was a swimming pool with heated salt water at second class, and our servants, our stewards, they took us to the swimming pool, and we would hang on the edge. That's the only way you wouldn't vomit. And then they would feed us crackers hanging on a rope in the swimming pool. I still remember my folks, you know, those people. We never knew, we never even seen this. The only swimming pool that I know was when I went to trade school. We had 2 hours a week of physical education. And our teacher, he was a real stubborn Dutchman. And we had to go to the swimming pool in Rotterdam. And we had to go in a fast pace, but he would lead off, and we would get there, and we had to learn how to swim, because every Dutchman has to know how to swim. And the way you swim is like a frog, you know, that's the only proper way to swim is like a frog. They had two poles with a pivot and a rope, and they put a harness on you with an eye in the back, and they tied a rope on there, and then they would let it down, and you had to do the breaststroke until you finally had it in your head, and then they would turn you loose, you had to swim. But now the rest of the story. There was a tower there, which was the height of a freighter, Dutch freighter, because Holland had a lot of freighters, and we had to jump off of that. Boy, I tell you what, that was one of the most scariest thing I ever did. It was pretty high. You had to jump and hope you came up again. Well, we... Yeah, I did.
He did, and he's still going strong at age 90. Time for our first break, but there's much more to come. More memories from the Netherlands during and after World War II, as well as this immigrant's journey to the land he loves. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for photos and a short video of Dutch. And remember, you can access the first part of his story from last week right there as well. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. On our last episode, we had a fascinating visit with 90-year-old Dutch Vryhof of Hanford, California, exploring how he survived the Nazi occupation of his native Holland and actively participated in the Dutch resistance. If you missed that episode, you can dial it up at hometownheroesradio.com. Today, we've heard about the day his village of Roan was liberated and also about how his family lost its land when power landed in socialist hands in the Netherlands after the war. Before we hear about his immigration journey to the U.S., let's get a few more memories from Holland.
I went to trade college. Think about this one. First of all, I had to be there at 7:30 in the morning, okay? And it was an hour bike, and I had to go to the Maas Tunnel, up into the stairways and all. That's a whole story in itself. So I would arrive there, and then I had to park my bike in the basement, and then there was a box underneath it with numbers, and that's where my wooden shoes went. And then we would all gathered in the basement. It was men only. It was all women, all men. We were all gathered there, and then the director, he would get on a little speaking stand, you know, and it was a Christian school. So he says, "Okay, good morning, gentlemen," in Dutch. And then he says, "I want to know, before we go into our devotions," he would read Bible, and then he would pray, and then we would be dismissed to the class. He says, "I want to get one thing into all of your head, and so you know it very well." He says, "You come here for one reason, and that's to learn. Now, if you got a different idea, you might as well raise your hand now, because if you get sent to my office by the teacher," he said, "you're out. And that means no job." I mean, that was the rule. And then he would read scripture, made a comment on it, and then he prayed, and then we were sent off to our classrooms. And then we had 30 minutes at noontime to eat the food which my mom packed for us, in a sandwich or whatever. And there was a field in front of the school, a soccer field. At least we had a ball. We didn't have a bladder of a pig, you know. We had a regular soccer ball. And so you would gobble your lunch up real quick-like, and then you would play soccer, and then you go back in. Saturday, had to be there at 7:30, and you would get out at 12:30, with no lunchtime, 12:30, to school 6 days a week. Christmas Day, 1 week vacation. Summer vacation? No, not such a thing as a summer vacation. No. And then Christmas, until I came here, the Christmas to me was two holidays for Christ. The first day you went to church, and they had programs at the church, and then they had the school children put on a program. The second day was the gathering of the family, and they would cook a nice meal, and we all come together as a family. And we would sing Silent Night in Dutch, you know, and all the hymns by the organ, because every Dutchman had an organ. A little, you know, they pumped it. It was not very big. That was all, came from way back. It was all family, passed on by the family. Yeah, that's how it was. It was neat, really. And on again at the church, the poor people, and I was one of the poor people, they had benches in the, and when you came into the church with numbers, and you put your wooden shoes in there, and then you went on those leather socks into the church. And then, and listen to this one, this is true too. This song, the church was old, very old. And it had the Ten Commandments, an enormous deal on the wall with letters, golden letters about this big. They had the upstairs, that is where the guy said, "We'll pump the organ." the organ had two big arms and a guy on each side, and they had to pump the organ to make it play. And my uncles, they were all over the organ garden. They sat upstairs. But in the wintertime, boy, all those people who sat upstairs, and including the organist, all of a sudden the organ would go, ah. And what happened, they had little stoves in the church. They were made out of oak like that, and there was holes on the top, and they had a little clay pot in it, and they put coals in there. And they paid for that. You had to have a little money. They paid for the seats, too. Otherwise, the Vryhof bands, there were six Vryhofs sitting in this, and they had a door on it, and my grandfather controlled it. But my grandmother and him, they had one of those things. Well, those fumes would all go up, and that carbon monoxide would put all those guys to sleep, and also the organist at times. You know, you think I'm telling you a joke, but I'm telling you the gospel truth, man. Those windows didn't open, you know. They only had, they had some windows that open, and then they would open them, and then they complained about it was too cold on the head, you know. I tell you, Paul, those are, I'm thinking back about all that.
Well, you've seen quite a few things, and I'm just interested in your perspective on America. Well, and maybe let's start here. So, you know, you grow up in a village that's been taken over by the Nazis. They're living in your house, and it's the Allies, the Americans, the British, the Canadian, who come and liberate you. Because I've talked to so many guys who went over there with that purpose in mind, to liberate Europe and to, you know, stop Hitler from what he was doing. How do you view those young Americans and Brits and Canadians and others who came to liberate your homeland?
They were our heroes, man. I mean, we would, whenever the planes would come over, we were in a big group, and we would all wave and carry on. And yeah, we did. And we would put a stake, and we put a flag on the top, and we would wave the flag. Yeah, that's what we did. And, you know, I was friends here with several of the guys who flew those missions, you know, Steve Otto, my racing buddy. I was involved in midget racing in Lemoore. And Steve, he was a tail gunner, because he was a short, heavy little set guy, and he would have to crawl from the front through a small area to the tail gunner position. That was the worst thing you can be as a tail gunner, because those German Messerschmitts, they would always try to kill the tail gunner, because he was, you know, he was pretty important, because he can hit a plane with his maneuverable cannon he had, a small cannon, and he can really put a plane out of commission. So the first thing they would go after would be after the tail gunner. Steve would tell me, you know, and he says, well, Dutch, he says, you know, we load up on coffee, first of all, to settle my nerves, he says, because I didn't know if I was going to make it back or not. And just as we would get over Holland, he said, we get over Rotterdam, or just on this side of it, he said, so probably at your village, he said, I had to go pee. So he said, I peed on a lot of Dutchmen's heads. Steve, he used to tell me the story. He got wounded, and he said, we landed on at four, they had four engines, you know. He said, and a couple of times they limped in on two engines and made it. And he said, and then when they were landing, he said, the third engine would quit, and they only landed on one. He said, it was kind of hairy and quite bumpy. And he said, I would close my eyes, and I say, and I make a cross. You know, he crossed himself because he was Catholic. And he says, and when I open my eyes, he says, I seen the service personnel running up and put the fire out, because he said usually one of those engines was on fire, you know. Boy, those guys had nerves, tell you that. And I mean, it was unbelievable what those guys did to free us and free the world, tell you the truth. It was really something, yeah. So our number came up, and then we got on the old New Amsterdam, and we got into Hoboken. And then we went to Ellis Island, and that is what I still remember. The nurses, they had this white cap with a red cross on it, and the doctors all had white coats, yeah, with a stethoscope hanging around the neck, and we were all examined, you know. Oh yeah, we didn't have, We were in Holland already. And now, you know, we got in Hoboken, and that's the Siemenshausen. It was all Dutch. Huh? And they received us, huh? And we stayed there for 3 days. And we had two big crates, and they unloaded them. The Siemenshausen would get us oriented, and they made signs of what to ask for. And then they put you on the steam train to Chicago. But then in Chicago, you had to change stations because we had to go on the steam train all the way to Utah. That was a big monster steam train, you know. So they told us we were going on two taxis. When we arrived in Chicago, we had to go on two taxis. My dad with the boys went in one, and mom and the girls went in the other. And they would bring us to the other station. And they already had said how much money that it was, and Dad had a Dutch wallet, and he put that money in there because they told him exactly how it was. Now, this is a true story. So we got to the Grand Central Station, and there was a sign there, and there was a couple of people standing there. One was a woman, and one was a man, and it said they were traveler aides. And those taxi drivers, they made my dad give him every dime he had. I mean, they cleaned him out. And, of course, there was a lot of Dutch talking going on and all, arms swinging. And that woman, she spoke Dutch. She knew Dutch. She was from Grand Rapids. And she overheard a commotion. And she blew a whistle, and here came the police. She had a special whistle she blew. Yeah. And they arrested those dudes. Oh, yeah. And they came with a paddy wagon. It was a real old model of a Ford type thing. And they loaded them up. Yes, that's the truth. This is really quite a story because we were lost, man. Grand Central Station was enormous, and trains from everywhere came to Grand Central Station. So the travel aide says, she says, she's taking Dutch to us, and we're just in Hog Heaven, you know, we talk somebody our language. Thank Jesus. Anyway, she says, you looked out. She says, I met a bosmas. It's a family, a man, an older man and woman, and he is a doctor. And he's visiting his son in Salt Lake City. And they're going to go on that train. And she says, I'll introduce him to you. Well, she did. And man, it was an answer to prayer, really. Because they took care of us. They got us food, you know, from the lunch wagon. And then they had a sleeper. But we slept in our seats. But they got blankets and pillows. And the seats folded and everything. 3 day ride. And then we got to see cowboys. Oh, man, I mean, we heard about the cowboys, and we went through all this prairie land, and we seen cowboys, man. Really, we did. Yeah. It was a big deal. Well, we got into Salt Lake, and it was on a Friday. We had a big welcome. The whole Baptist church was there, and we weren't Baptist, but that was okay. They were really good people, man, good people. And they really took care of us. They gave us all kinds of stuff. And on, they had rented a house, yeah, all that kind of stuff. And our sponsor was there, of course, and he put on a big meal at the church, yeah. And on my uncle, he spoke English very well. We didn't speak English at all. All we had was the cards. And so, you know, my dad said, thank Mr. Roberts and Mrs. Roberts for being our sponsors and stuff. And it was all done. And then Mr. Roberts, who was our sponsor, he told my uncle that I would have go to work on Monday already and have a job. And my dad would have a job too. He would go to work for Mr. Roberts, who was our sponsor, and he had a big crew that took care of his beautiful layout. And he and that was a gardener and stuff, so he would go to work for him. And I went to work for Herman Shoker, and he had a Herman Shoker's garage and wrecking yard on between State Street and Main Street on Harvard. And I went to work there on Monday morning, bright and early, with my coveralls, which I brought from Holland, and I went to work over there as a mechanic. Didn't know his word English, but I knew mechanics pretty well. He spoke a little German. His parents had came from Germany. So I got along with him well. I could communicate, and that was good. So I went to work on the trucks of the cement company, the big cement trucks, and also the pickups, and we had all kinds of stuff, and we worked on all that.
Decades later, he's still working on cars, even raced them for a while. It's time for our final break, but as much history as he experienced in surviving all of World War II in the Netherlands, Dutch was also an eyewitness, unintentionally, to another piece of history in the middle of his family's migration to Central California. You won't want to miss that chapter of Dutch Fryhoff's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a two-part conversation with a member of the Dutch Underground in World War II, 90-year-old Dutch Fryhoff of Hanford, California. If you missed last week's episode and his memories of life under Nazi occupation, you can pull that up at hometownheroesradio.com.
Well, I've got a few more questions for you. And if there's anything that I didn't ask you about, feel free to add. Can you help us understand what America means to you? I mean, I see you flying that flag out there. I'm sure there's a reason. What does America represent in your mind?
It was the biggest thing when I became a citizen. I went to citizenship school, and my whole family did. We went to Mrs. Drennan taught us at the high school. Two nights a week we went to citizenship. We had to learn how to read, how to speak, and how to write English. I mean, and it was serious. There was all kinds of them in our class. There was Portuguese, quite a few Portuguese. Yeah. There was some Spanish and some other people, Germans too. And we really put all our effort in it to do that. And then we had to learn the Constitution backwards and forwards. I mean, we really did. And then we had to pass an exam. And we did pass the exam. And then it wasn't just, we'll give it to you anyway. No, there was some people had to redo it because they didn't know it. My folks, you know, and they never did get used to the culture over here. In Holland, it is more closer. And here it is more spread out. You know what I'm saying? Well, on Christmas was a big thing over here, and we didn't send the class till December the 5th. That's when we have our stuff for pastries and color books and stuff like that for the kids. That's on December the 5th. That's the saint out of Spain. He has the rod and the big cap on his head and on Zwarte Piet, those were two black guys, daughter guys were with him, and they were his helper with a sack on their back, and if you had been not nice, then you wouldn't get candy, you know. So that was on December, still that way. But I didn't know Christmas tree, I didn't know what a Christmas tree was, you know. But the thing, man, when we became citizens, oh boy, that was just, we We wrote to Holland about us, sent pictures. We had pictures in the paper. I got pictures from the paper and everything in my citizenship package. I have it all in the office. And then that was one of the most, because before we left, that was the most unbelievable thing for anybody to go to America. I mean, you were looked up to, man. You're going to America. Oh, that's really something. But after we came here, we went to Salt Lake. I was working two jobs. I worked at Helmer Schoker. I went to work over there at 7:30 in the morning, and I worked till 2 o'clock. And then at 3 o'clock, we left for Hill Air Force Base in Ogden, and I worked as a landing gear inspector, as a civilian personnel. And I was really the base commander. I was on his throne about this tall. And they were testing the jets over there. They had to build a wall because it was blowing the windows out of the administrative building at Hill Air Force. No, true. The Korean War was still going on. Full blast. Anyway, it was quite a job. I got that because of a Dutchman. But anyway, I had a terrific job. And we rode every day in a carpool. So, that those boss masks, his nephew was a minister here in Hanford. And he said, you know, you probably should go to Hanford, see what it is like. I was the only driver. I had a 41 Plymouth, but by now I had gotten a 46 Pontiac with an Indian head lit up in the hood, 6-cylinder, 3 on the column. I was the only driver. So it was a weekend, a holiday weekend. We drove to Hanford. I did all the driving, drove to Hanford. And there was all two-lane roads. Right smack through Las Vegas. The road went right through the city of sin. Anyway, we came into Hanford, and of course, you know, that was right up my dad's alley. So we were going to move. We moved to Hanford. Now, quickly, and as a real bad story, we had a Pontiac, all 8 of us. I'm the driver, and a shepherd dog, a German shepherd. We had gotten as a present from one of the Baptists, gave us a German shepherd dog. Beautiful dog. So, my Uncle Leonard, who was lined out the Pacific Fruit trucks, and he told us, he says, now, after you go through Vegas, there is a road, it's a dirt road, and there's a sign, and it goes way out in the desert, and he said, that's what our trucks use to overnight. He said, they drive in there, and there's no thieves or none, and they drive in there quite a ways, and then they turn around. He says, now mark it all out, that's what you're going to have to do. So, I'm driving. We went to the Army Surplus Store. Now, I didn't want to know what an Army Surplus Store was, but my Uncle Leonard went in there and got those heavy Army blankets, you know, those dark green heavy Army, wool blankets, 2 water bags hanging on the front of the Pontiac, you know what I'm talking about, yeah. Water bags on the bumper, all kinds of food wrapped up, and there was an old-fashioned ice chest, and they went to the church, and they had an refrigerator what made ice. We didn't have that, but the church had it, so they got ice to get, and was not very much. Anyway, we started out. Now, this is true. We got into Las Vegas, and it was already dark, and you went right smack to the main drag in Las Vegas, and all the lights of all the casinos, and my mom, she was very believing Christian, and she prayed a lot and learned us how to pray. And she says, okay, she says, Leonard is the only one, Lane, who can open his eyes. The rest of us have to all close our eyes because the devil lives here and we sure don't want to see him or we don't want him to get in our car. And we parked the Pontiac and Mom and the girls were in the car. The dog was tied to the back bumper and Dad and us, we had a sleeping bag. And those were Army sleeping bags. I never knew about a sleeping bag, but Uncle Leonard had shown us how to use it and zip it up and all that. And we were all spread out there on the army canvas, laid it on the ground first because there were scorpions out there. About 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't know what time it was. I'm telling you, Paul, we woke up. The earth shook. We couldn't even stand up. There was a wind that was so strong that we were covered with dirt, dust, and tumbleweeds. There was a ball of fire in the sky, and we couldn't even look into it. Mom is on the cry, and she's praying to Jesus, because we thought the world came to an end. Now, this is a true story. The dog broke loose, and he took off, and we couldn't move, and we couldn't even stand up. The ground shocked so bad, we could not stand up. And the sky, this big ball, I never forget it. We got to our senses, and the morning started to break. We were filthy dirty. And we packed up everything, and we drove down the road a little ways, and there was a service station with the hand pumps, Shell. All the windows were blowing out, and there was hundreds of chickens dead, all laying against the fence. And there was two people there, a man and a wife, older people, and they lived upstairs. We stopped, and they had been ordered to leave because they were going to have the first above-ground atomic explosion. That's what we went through. They were just beyond themselves. All the glass was out of the windows. The doors were broken down. There was hundreds of chickens from the wind, all killed against the fence. She had a wood stove, and she hid it with water, and she washed it with liquid soap. Really, I still remember it. She was an older lady. And then he hand-pumped fuel, and it was 18 cents a gallon, into the car. And you know, later on, Dad died of it.
You're saying he died from radiation exposure?
Later on, yeah. I don't think Dad washed himself very good, you know. He was an old Dutchman, and the bathing was not all that number top. But you know, in Holland, we had a big tub, and we had a little load against the house, and Mom used to heat water in the wood stove, and then once a week we took a bath. Boys went first, and then the girls, and then the curls were so bad that Mom had to scoop them off, add hot water, because it took a long time to heat the hot water on the stove. Well, anyway, come back at this. We arrived in Hanford. Then later on, Don Foss had the insurance agency, and they had a home in New Mexico. He was friends with some of those professors, and we got a trip to the hill, a secret place where they developed the atom bomb, you know? Mm-hmm. And we went up there. And we were the guests of the principal, or whatever, the dean of the university. The hour and the pictures were right there from the explosion. We were there. And they had several hundred guys, army guys, with special masks and special shields. Oh, and the cloud went over St. George, Utah. It killed up, I forgot how many hundred sheep it killed, because that cloud blew over St. George, Utah. And that's all documented. Now, Dad got an immune thing, and it was from radiation. He lost his eyesight, and then finally, he lost all his circulation. Dr. Kerr took one of his legs off. I was there with him, and he had Dutch nurse in the hospital because he didn't speak English.
And I'm sure we could tell a lot of stories about racing and working on cars. And I'm just wondering now, I know you're still going, you're still wholesaling cars and working on them and all that. But at age 90, is there something that you look back on and you say, you know, that's what I'm most proud of?
I was married for 66 years to May, and we raised a family, and I miss her. But she's in heaven. Her soul went to Jesus, so I'm okay with that. And I found a friend, a Dutch gal. Her folks were born and raised in Holland, and so were her grandparents. She's from Ripon, and her husband was my friend of all things. We run around together over here in Hanford, Bill Blanken, and she married him, and they were married for 63 years, I believe. May died in February, and he died 2 months later, and we're kind of friends. But I look back, you know, and I can tell you this, for sure, and I tell that to the whole world. I was poor. My folks were poor. I always took care of them because since I was a little kid, know what to do. The Dutch thing is, and they drain that in you with all their might. You are the oldest. Jij bent de oudste. Jij bent verantwoordelijk. You are responsible for all your brothers and sisters. They had a free right. I was the oldest, and I don't feel bad about it or nothing. But it kind of made you a little bossy because it was drilled into you. You know what I'm saying? That's the truth.
Quite a journey Dutch Fryhoff has been on over the last 90 years. Don't forget to check out the video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll see a souvenir that he's held on to from the celebration of Holland's liberation 78 years ago. I want to say a special thank you to loyal Hometown Heroes listener Patty Briney for letting me know about Dutch and his unique story. And one final reminder, this comes coming Thursday, December 7th. That's Pearl Harbor Day. So find a commemoration in your community that you can be a part of. And if you can't, perhaps just pause that day to remember the over 2,400 Americans who perished on that day of infamy. We're going to talk more about that next time on Hometown Heroes, where we try to keep at least this one important reality in view. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.